So before I start telling you how when electrons may break apart in condensed matter physics, let me sort of remind you of some more conventional more conventional solid state physics. Most of our understanding of the theory of metals, the quantum theory of metals, is based on a certain theory which has been around for many decades now. And it's called Fermi liquid theory. And the basic claim or the basic result of this theory is just that for an interacting electron system such as exists in a real metal, a more or less correct description, a qualitatively correct and an excellent description is just given by the non-interacting, by solving the non-interacting electron problem. It's an excellent description. So given the central importance of the non-interacting electron gas, let me first remind you of some very basic properties of the non-interacting electron gas. Let's take the simplest possible situation. If you have just electrons moving around without, and ignore, in a translationally invariant system, there are lots of, you can imagine solving the, it's a free particle moving around, and the energy eigenstates depend on the value of the energy of the single particle, depend on the momentum, and in the simplest case it's just a quadratic dispersion with some mass, which is whatever it is. Right now, at zero temperature, if you have a certain number of electrons in the system, you just fill up all these levels all the possible levels available for the electron, and to get the ground state of this of a system of a large number of electrons, we just keep filling up these states in a manner that's consistent with the Pauli principle. Given that the electrons are fermions, you basically can put exactly one electron in any given quantum state, and with spin, you label each available state by the momentum and the spin, and so in the ground state, you just fill. You keep filling up these levels, and you start filling up the levels of the lowest energies first. And for any given density, you'd have to basically fill up all the levels with momenta, which is said that the momentum is smaller than some fixed value of the momentum, which is in turn determined by the density. Right? So you fill up levels with momentum smaller than some definite value of the momentum, which is determined by the density. And so pictorially, in momentum space, you'd have filled up all the states that have momenta which is smaller than this value kf. And this momentum is called the Fermi momentum. And the energy of this highest occupied state, the energy that corresponds to the momentum kf, is called the Fermi energy. Right, and this surface in momentum space which separates the occupied electronic states from the unoccupied ones, that surface is called the Fermi surface. Right, all this, of course, I'm sure familiar to everybody here, but sort of useful to keep this in, to sort of remind people of this thing. So it's a basic property of the quantum theory of a system with lots of electrons. Lots of non-interacting electrons, and there's the surface in momentum space which separates states that are occupied from states that are not occupied, and the states that are occupied have momenta that can be fairly large. I mean, all values at the moment are up to some maximum amount that's determined by the density or occupied in the ground state of the system. One can actually see this thing directly. If you imagine taking a solid, a metallic solid, and trying to knock out electrons by, say, shining light or something on the system. If this is your solid, and you imagine coming in with some photon and trying to kick out an electron from the solid, right, with some definite momentum and with some definite energy, you can ask what the intensity is of this emitted electron, right? So let's call the intensity some function of the momentum and the frequency of the ejected electron. Now, if you plot this as function of frequency for a fixed momentum, then this understanding of the non-interacting electron problem tells us that if the magnitude of this momentum is smaller than this Fermi momentum, then there would be a delta function peak at an energy which is just k squared over 2m, which is smaller than the Fermi energy. And if the magnitude of this momentum is bigger than kF, then there's basically no intensity at all. So this is just telling you that you can kick out electrons with any value of the momentum smaller than the Fermi momentum, but you can't kick out electrons with any value of the momentum bigger than the Fermi momentum, simply because there are no such electrons in the system. So this is more or less a direct way in which one might imagine probing the fact that there are electrons in the metal which have momenta with fairly large values up to some sharp, well-defined momentum. Right, so all this is just about the non-interacting electron problem. Now, with interactions, which of course exist in real materials, the basic result of this theory, Fermi liquid theory, is that the basic picture of the system does not change at all from the non-interacting situation. Right, and in particular, if you again try to imagine performing this sort of an experiment in which you kicked out an electron from the sample, you'd more or less see essentially the same kind of picture, especially if the momentum of the electron is extremely close to the Fermi momentum. So what you would see is that, in particular, that as the energy of the ejected electron approaches the Fermi energy, you would see an extremely sharp peak in this quantity, which is basically telling you whether or not you can kick out an electron from the sample at that particular momentum and that particular energy, and the width of this peak goes to zero as you approach the Fermi energy. So this tells you that as you approach the Fermi energy, you can essentially just kick out ordinary electrons from inside the material. Right. So another way of saying this is that at low energies, as you approach the Fermi energy, there are excitations in this interacting Fermi system which have exactly the same quantum numbers as an electron. Right? So there are excitations that carry the charge and the spin of the electron. Right? And in some sense, that's the sort of basic result of this, the basic statement of Fermi liquid theory. And as I'm sure most of you know, Fermi liquid theory offers an excellent description of most of the conventional metallic systems that one is familiar with and so on in solid state physics. Now, so this more or less conventional solid state physics. Now, in modern solid state physics, it turns out that there are lots of experimental systems and theoretical situations in which it's not so clear that this sort of Fermi liquid picture of some interacting many electron system is a valid description at all. Right now, of course, I won't try to make a detailed list for you of all the experimental systems where one suspects that this sort of description is not correct. But among the various ways in which the Fermi liquid kind of description can go wrong, one of the most interesting ways from a theoretical point of view, more conceptual point of view, is a suggestion that's basically been around in some form or the other for two or three decades now, that in certain strongly interacting electron systems, the quantum numbers of the excitations above the ground state may not resemble those of the electron at all, and in particular, it may be fractions of those of the electron. Right? So the possibility that one would like to think about is that the excitations carry quantum numbers that are fractions of the electron. Right, so loosely speaking, one says that the electron is broken apart in these systems, that if you try to inject an electron into such a system, it won't propagate a single free excitation, but rather it would split into lots of different components, each one of which would propagate as free excitations in the system, more or less free excitations. Right, I said this sort of suggestion has been around for many, many years now, few decades. So there are reasonably, in fact, very well-known examples in certain special situations that this sort of thing can happen, that the electron can indeed break apart into lots of excitations which carry quantum numbers which are fractions of the electron. The first such theoretical example, which I think goes back to probably about three decades or so, came from understanding in a fairly serious way the properties of the interacting electron gas in one spatial dimension. Right, so this is in spatial dimension and it was found that Fermi liquid theory breaks down arbitrarily weak electron-electron interactions in one spatial dimension, and in particular, that the electron is not a fundamental excitation in a one-dimensional interacting electron gas, but rather the excitations are those that carry spin but no charge. That's one kind of excitation. So it's have the electron which carries electrical charge 1 and spin 1/2. And but in generically in one dimensions, what was found to happen through theoretical solutions of various models was that the excitations are things that carried spin but no charge, or charge but no spin. Right, so the two excitations of the system did not have the quantum numbers of the electron, but rather they either carried, just the spin but not the charge, or vice versa. Right, so this example it's something that is well known in solid state physics, and it's under excellent control theoretically and so on. The second example that you could have interacting many electron systems where the excitations carry fractional quantum numbers is also equally well known. It's mean, and it occurs in the fractional quantum Hall effect. So let me remind you, I'm sure most people have at least heard about the fractional quantum Hall effect. Let me remind you that the quantum Hall effect is a phenomenon that occurs in a two-dimensional electron gas in the presence of a strong magnetic field, an extremely strong magnetic field. And so what happens is that if you measure the, if you took such a two-dimensional electron gas and you, in a strong magnetic field, which is, say, coming out of the board, I don't know how people draw that, it's like this or something. If you measured what's called the Hall conductivity of the system, which is you imagine that you applied a potential difference across this end of the sample and you measure the electrical current that you get in the transverse direction, and you can define a conductivity associated with that, the so-called Hall conductivity. And this Hall conductivity takes on certain quantized values. Its values quantized in units of some fundamental constants, the Planck constant, the charge of the electron, and so on, for certain range of fields at strong magnetic fields. That's the quantum Hall effect. And when people first did notice this sort of quantization of this Hall conductance, what they found was that this was quantized to be equal to some integer times e squared over h. Right. Now, later people did more accurate experiments and found that it was not necessarily just quantized to an integer. But this number m could even be some rational fraction. For instance, one particular value which was, I guess, the initial discovery was that this number m could be equal to 1 over 3. And the effect when this m is quantized to be an integer is called the integer quantum Hall effect. And when m is quantized to be 1 over 3, it's called the fractional quantum Hall effect for obvious reasons. Now, shortly after the discovery of the fractional quantum Hall effect, a theory was proposed, a correct theory of the effect was proposed by Laughlin. And one of the aspects of this theory is that the correct description of the ground state of the system when it shows this fractional quantum Hall effect with m equals 1/3 is such that if you looked at the excitations above the ground state, then there are excitations which carry an electrical charge that is 1/3 that of the electron. Right. So at that time at least, there's another example of a prediction of fractional quantum numbers in a condensed matter system. Okay. D equals 1, I'm told that there are very recent experiments on carbon nanotubes. I guess Leon Balance is involved with those experiments, though he's a theorist, where people were trying to tunnel electrons into the nanotube and found that it was very difficult to get them in at low voltages, simply because you have to. The electron is not there in the system, so it's sort of difficult to put it in. It has to break apart. It's sort of indirect evidence for separation of spin and charge quantum numbers in 1D. Sort of very direct measurement, but it's consistent with the general theory. For the experiment on carbon nanotubes, since Leon was one of the experimentalists, I urge you to talk to him too. But I take it that it's just doing these tunneling experiments, right? For the fractional quantum Hall effect, there are much more convincing, much more serious demonstrations of the fractional charge of the quasi of the excitations. Laughlin, who sort of dreamed up of this thing, claims that the very existence of this fractionalization of the Hall conductance, the very existence of a plateau at one-third, is a demonstration that you have fractionally charged excitations. Yeah, that is indirect, but he would say that it's implied and there's no way you can have this without this. Right.
Nobel Prize was given away after these noise measurements.
So there are more recent experiments which so-called short noise experiments which apparently also see more directly that there are excitations that charge one-third. Yeah. Experimentally, is it? Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the experimental situation on polyacetylene. So there is some amount of evidence and for fractionalization in both of these systems, and the quantum Hall effect in particular, it's on fairly firm basis, both theoretically and experimentally, and here definitely on firm ground theoretically and on reasonably firm ground experimentally, I guess. There are some special situations in which one could imagine understanding them. I guess Rajiv Singh gave a talk a few weeks back on precisely that sort of thing. If you, for instance, imagine, let's take a very special one-dimensional system, right? Let's imagine a spin chain, right? And in particular, consider it, consider what's known as an XXZ spin chain, where you make sure that the exchange interaction, which is some interaction that tends to either align or anti-align spins up in neighboring sites, is such that it preferably favors alignment along the Z direction as opposed to the alignment in the XY plane. And if the tendency to align along the Z direction is extremely strong, then you would imagine the system, the ground state of the system is such that, or rather the tendency to anti-align along the Z direction is extremely small, then the ground state of the system is such that the spins are basically doing this. So the spins are pointing along the Z direction, but they're pointing up and down. Now you can imagine that you can ask what the excitations about this ground state are. And one particular excitation that you can imagine is one in which you've flipped the spin of in one half of the system. Right, and it's fairly easy to show that excitation carries a fraction of the, it carries a spin along the Z direction of a half, which is a fraction of what you would naively have guessed in a spin system, because when you flip a spin, the spin changes by one, right? But here you've gotten an excitation that has a spin of a half. So that's one limit in which you can sort of understand it pictorially. The simplest sort of limit in which you can understand this. Okay, I'll just give the talk, and at the end you can tell me how similar it is. But in any case, the point I wanted to make here is that it's not totally crazy to imagine that you could have fractionalization of the electron in condensed matter systems. But on the other hand, both these examples are extremely special examples. This, after all, in 1D, and most systems are not in one dimension. And this is in two dimensions, but it's in an extremely strong magnetic field. The quantum Hall effect occurs under very special conditions. And one may wonder whether it's just some exotic property of these exotic situations, or whether, more generally, one could get this fractionalization of the electron in other contexts as well. Especially when you don't impose any special restrictions of, 1D, such as 1D or extremely strong fields which break time reversal symmetry and so on. Right. And also, both these things have been known to the community, the solid state community, for decades. As I said, this goes back to about 3 decades, and this has been known for about 20 years, more or less since the discovery of the fractional quantum Hall effect. I guess separate talks can be given on each one of these, and indeed we've had blackboard lunches on these things. So I'm not going to talk about these any further. Rather, I'm going to move on to a story that's not as finished as both these examples, but a story in which there has been a lot of progress recently. So that's what justifies giving this talk at all. So I'm going to leave these systems that are fairly well understood and move on to a system that's basically not understood at all. Or rather, there may be an understanding, but nobody knows whether the understanding that anybody has is correct or not. Right, and they... so as many of you may have guessed, this is the cuprate HTC materials. And I'm sure lots of you have seen phase diagrams of these materials as a function of temperature and doping and so on. So let me sort of draw a schematic phase diagram. This number is, I'll call it X, it's what's known as doping. An example of what X may be is to look at some particular HTC material, such as and X would be the amount of strontium you put in place of the lanthanum. But in general, this is, this is X. Right. Now, so the phase diagram, which people have probably seen a zillion times, looks like this. And there are lots of things happening out here and so on. So out here, the system is an anti-ferromagnet. What that means is that there is some spin structure in the system. The spins are basically, there is some magnetic order in the system out here. The spins have arranged themselves on the lattice formed by these systems, particularly the copper the copper atoms, into some arrangement which basically goes up and down from one atom to the next atom in the lattice. So that's the antiferromagnet. And as you increase X, as you increase the amount of doping, the system goes into the famous superconducting state with the transition temperature that's higher than most of the other materials known to date, which is what justifies calling them HTC materials. Now, lots of aspects of these materials, particularly out here in this region, is not understood at all, not understood at the same comment as before. And one suggestion that's basically been made in the context of trying to understand this region is basically that it's sort of useful and perhaps necessary to imagine that the electron has broken apart, and that that it's these broken fragments that are the correct way to think about the system in this region, right? So that's been a suggestion that's been around in the field for a long time. Basically, just after the first experiments on HTC materials, I guess it was Anderson who proposed this who came up with the suggestion. But anyway, that, as I said, there is no agreement on whether it's a right suggestion or not. But nevertheless, let me sort of quickly mention a certain number of experiments on these materials, which might sort of be taken, or rather, which have been proposed by various people in the field as evidence that it is correct that the electron does indeed break apart in these materials. Right. So most of these experiments that I'm going to talk about have actually been done in this part of the phase diagram. It's what's known to, in field as the underdoped region, under because it's you're not doped it enough to get the maximum possible TC. Right. So the first set of experiments in this region are those that directly probe the properties of the spin of the electron out here. And one result is that that's come out of various experiments over the last several years is that below a certain temperature, below some T star, right, which is supposed to come down like this, there is a suppression. Just sort of summarizing the experiments of the density of the spin-carrying excitations. And so one can tell that this is happening by, for instance, measuring the spin susceptibility of the system in this region, or by looking at how various nuclei relax. We're doing NMR experiments and so on. And all of those experiments basically tell you that, the temperature dependence of various quantities, such as the spin susceptibility or the NMR rate, is such that it's, as you cool it through this temperature, it just falls down considerably from what it used to be. So it sort of suggests that there are fewer spin-carrying excitations that you're exciting fewer spin-carrying excitations as you cool through this temperature. And so that's one set of experiments. Sorry? Oh, no. This is just, I'm just going to, this is the first set of experiment that I've mentioned, right? And, okay, but as a preemptive sort of comment, I'm not listing out any sort of experiments as proof or disproof of any particular theory. I'm just sort of putting together some of the experiments that various people in the field have quoted as evidence for spin charge separation. Right? Now, whether one agrees or disagrees with that is a different matter, and I won't attempt to address that right now. The second set of experiments are those that probe the charge physics. And in this context, it's actually important to distinguish between two different kinds of probes of the charge physics. As many of you may know, the structure of these materials is such that there are lots of layers, and each layer is formed by copper and oxygen. And it's believed that all the activity, the electronic activity, place in these layers. And okay, in the real system, of course, you have to worry about exactly how these different layers are coupled together. Right? So it's important to distinguish between the set of experiments that probe the properties of the charge physics in these systems. One question that one would like to ask and understand is how easy or how difficult is it for charge to move across the system? And you have to distinguish between experiments that measure how easy it is for charge to move within a layer from experiments that ask how easy it is for charge to move perpendicular to the layers. Right? So those experiments that probe the motion of charge within each layer, right, so it's the in-plane charge dynamics, So such experiments, particularly at low frequency, like for instance the DC electrical transport in this region, seem to show an effect that's not as strong as what happens in the spin sector below this T star. Right. So at low frequencies, this sort of this is the experimental statement. The effects are weaker than in the spin physics. The effects meaning this sort of suppression of the density of spin carrying excitations. Then it's sort of difficult to quantify exactly what one means by weaker. Right? But on the other hand, for instance, if you measure the spin susceptibility, what's seen in the data is that it's more or less flat, and roughly speaking, and then it falls down before the system goes superconducting. This is T star. And similarly in the NMR relaxation rate and so on. Now for the resistivity, which measures the charge dynamics, the DC resistivity in the plane, right, as a function of temperature, it's linear at high temperature and more or less extrapolating zero. Now below this T star, there is a change from the linear dependence, but it basically looks like this, right? So if you look at the plot in the full temperature range in which these measurements are taken, there is definitely an effect occurring at around T star, but the effect, at least on the face of it, looks to be reasonably small, extremely small in fact.
I don't know exactly how you'll get it, right? But there are too many people who are doing basic conventional thermal liquid phase physics who come up with sort of convincing explanation for this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't want to prefer anybody. I'm not telling you whether I like it or not either. I'm just telling you that this is what people have quoted as evidence for some exotic physics going on in the tube plates, right? But anyway, more importantly than any of this, there are other things you can ask about about charge transport out here, and that too can be this thing. But anyway, just these two facts may make one wonder. It may not be true. There may be more simpler explanations and so on. And that perhaps it is correct to imagine that the electron is breaking apart in these systems into excitations that just carry the spin and excitations that just carry the charge. And that something is happening to the spin as you cool out here, and that of course indirectly affects the charge dynamics. So that perhaps explains the small change. But since it's indirect, the effects are much weaker than the spin physics. Right? It's a plausible idea. Whether it works out or not, one doesn't know. But anyway, people have suggested it. Right? But the most important sort of experiment that sort of hints at the fact that perhaps this proposal that the spin and charge do separate out, the spin and charge electron do separate out and move as essentially independent excitations, comes from measuring this quantity, which is basically in this sort of an experiment where you move into the system, where you kick out an electron from the system using light and ask to see what the intensity of the emitted electron beam is. Right? And as I said, in a Fermi liquid, you basically get a sharp peak in this quantity as the energy of the ejected electron approaches the Fermi energy. Now, in these high-TC systems, particularly out here, what one sees is that there is no sharp quasi-particle peak at all. There is no sharp peak that you expect to get in a Fermi liquid. I could show you some data So these are experiments that basically measure that same quantity that I was talking about. And the dashed lines are the experiments done above TC, about 10 degrees Kelvin above TC. And the solid lines refer to what happens inside the superconductor. And you can see that the superconductor is a more or less conventional beast, and you get this sharp peak as very close to Fermi energy. This is a superconductor with a TC of about 90 degrees. Now, as you go above TC, just into the normal state, you see that this extremely sharp peak has broadened out enormously, and you do not see any sharp feature at all. And these other curves are for experiments done on samples at smaller and smaller TCs, so that you're going into this underdoped side. And this dashed line, which refers to this to the spectrum in the normal state, basically does not show any signs at all of having any sharp peak. Right? So, which could perhaps be taken as strong evidence that it's not correct to think in terms of electrons as being the excitation of the system. And perhaps it's more correct to think in terms of the electron breaking apart and becoming, electron being some sort of composite object which breaks into lots of separate excitations.
What is the difference between this test of
beta? You're under doping the system as you go down, right? The TC goes down. Okay, that's all there was to do with the.
Yeah.
Sorry? Sure, yeah.
It boils down to sort of, realizing at high temperature, lots of, stations around
theories of what?
Fermionic dirt.
Okay.
It's so easy to get incoherent background space.
Absolutely. As I said, I wasn't offering any of these as proofs. I was just saying that these are the sorts of things that have motivated various people in the field over the last 13 or so years to propose that.
What's the direct evidence for having beautifully propagating particles carrying other quantum numbers than the electrons?
I'm not saying that there's any direct evidence. The field is in such a confused state that I don't want to. My intention is not to say that some theory is right or some theory is wrong. As you'll see, my intention is more to address some theoretical questions that are raised by these proposals, which you can always do. And once you resolve those theoretical questions, you can go ahead and see if these explanations make any sense at all. Right? I think the theory is in too bad a shape for you to make any, to get into serious fights about interpreting experiments. Okay. Anyway, so the point out here from all these experiments that people have suggested is that perhaps in this system, which is not like any of the other special systems we talked about, that perhaps even out here the electron does break apart into separate spin and charge carrying excitations. Right? So the obvious theoretical question that is raised by these proposals, which one must confront if these proposals are to be made out into a sensible theory, which one can then use to interpret experiments, is, what the theoretical basis is for saying that the electron can break apart into separate spin and charge carrying excitations in systems that are not as special as the systems that one knows about. Right, so what we need is a theory for the fractionalization of the electron. So it's a theory for the fractionalization of the electron as opposed to a theory for HTC superconductivity. And so this is a different question, which may, of course, it is motivated by the cuprate materials, and it may have some bearing on many of the experimental issues there. But on the other hand, it may not, right? And so I don't want to get into that aspect of the question. But nevertheless, I do want to provide you with some theoretical answers to the question of whether we can describe and understand the possibility of the electron breaking apart in not so special situations. Right. Now, people have been trying to do this for a long time. They've been trying to sort of theoretically describe and understand electron fractionalization in systems with strong electron interactions, motivated again by the HTC. Shortly after these proposals, lots of people tried to sort of put this proposal on firm ground. Many of those people are sitting in the audience. So the very early theoretical attempts basically looked at models that were very well motivated from the microscopic physics of the cuprate materials. And these were models which had sort of the electrons lived on a lattice, and the strong repulsor interaction between the electrons were taken into account by somehow saying that the interactions are so strong that you can have, that basically it costs an infinite amount of energy to put two electrons on the same lattice site, and so on and so forth. Now, in these attempts to sort of describe and understand the breaking of the electron, what people did was it's a simple idea. You take the electron operator with its spin, alpha is in spin index, and you formally rewrite this as a product of two other operators, right? And you demand that this B operator is bosonic, and this F operator is fermionic, and that B carries all the, so B dagger creates an excitation that carries the electrical charge but has no spin, and that it's a boson, and the F creates an object, the F dagger creates an object which has charge zero, that's a spin, and it's a fermion. Oh, you could do that too. People have played around with all such schemes, but I just want to illustrate one.
But would that lead to different results?
No, if you treated the problem exactly, then yes, in approximations you get different results.
Right,
yes.
So if you do mean to approximation, you don't know which one to trust.
Okay, so let me just comment on saying the. No, so long as you're doing things exactly, it doesn't matter. Any formulation is right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about these in detail, but I just want to sort of make one comment. So the idea was that you basically reformulate the theory in terms of these new operators, these new particles, and then you look for phases, for quantum phases, in which these particles, which is just more or less introduced ad hoc, have some separate meaning and independent existence. And if you have achieved it, then you demonstrated the possibility of obtaining a quantum phase in which the excitations of these objects instead of the electron. Right. Now, in attempting to implement this program, one obvious thing that comes out at you is that this representation of the electron operator is somewhat redundant, and in particular, there is a symmetry in which you change the phase of, you basically take this F alpha and change its phase by e to the I theta, and you change the phase of the B by e to the minus I theta, and this leaves the electron operator invariant. Right, so now since one is doing this at each site of the lattice, you can do this sort of rotation, phase rotation at each site of the lattice when you re-express the theory in terms of these fields. And so what you end up doing in this new formulation is that you introduce an extra gauge symmetry Right, so this leads to a gauge symmetry, and the correct theory that and the reformulated theory in terms of these variables is a gauge theory, but in this particular case a U1 gauge symmetry formulated on a lattice. Right, so it's a lattice gauge theory of coupled to these sort of excitations. The question of whether or not you get fractionalization or whether you get conventional electrons can be phrased as a question of the phase diagram of this lattice gauge theory and whether the theory is in its confining or deconfining phase. Right, so the idea was that somehow a lattice gauge that this entire question of fractionalization can be formulated in the language of lattice gauge theories and use whatever we know about lattice gauge theories. And this program ran into some difficulties, I think. Somewhat unfortunately, the resulting lattice gauge theories, the simplest formulation is just a U1 gauge symmetry, but people have explored other possibilities where you break up the electrons more differently and you get some SU2 gauge symmetry. What one ultimately seemed to have done at the end of the day was to trade some strongly interacting electron problem to another strongly interacting problem in terms of some other fields, but now also strongly interacting with the gauge field. So it seemed as though there was one intractable problem that was being traded for another intractable problem. And it seemed extremely difficult to basically answer this question of whether or not these objects had any separate meaning or not. And at least in some simple situations where people could do some calculations for on physically relevant models, SU2 spins and so on, the results seemed to indicate that basically you could not get phases in which these things had separate existence, and that they were getting confined together, and that the excitations were just ordinary electrons. Right, and those at least in part responsible for some of the skepticism that's been shown towards these theories which advocated spin charge separation, the breaking up of the electron as a cure to some of to the mysteries of the experiments in HTC systems. Right. So that's all that I'm going to say about these earlier approaches. The reason I'm giving this talk is that there's been lots of recent progress in the last year, couple of years, in understanding and describe in both a physical and mathematical understanding and description of the possibility of the electron breaking apart. What emerges is that, there are two slightly different ways of thinking about of formulating and describing fractionalization. One way, I'll just give the names of both ways of doing the same thing, which and then I'll describe to you the basic physics and give some flavor of how these theories manage to separate out the break the electron. One way is to think in a language which is to reformulate the interacting electron problem in terms of some other variables, which I'll just call them vortices for the time being. And in one description, you achieve fractionalization by pairing together these vortices, which are this different set of variables that you use to describe the same problem, and you condense these vortices. Right? I'll sort of elaborate on the physics of this in a little while. And the other sort of way of thinking about the same thing is in terms of is to go back to some of these earlier approaches and think in terms of a gauge theory, but it's been possible basically to come up with a gauge theory that one can actually analyze in various limits. And this gauge theory is based on the group Z2, so it's an Ising symmetry. So it's a Z2 gate theory description of the strongly interacting electron problems, at least in certain situations, that one can analyze quite reliably and demonstrate and basically describe the fractionalization of the electron. So both these ways of thinking about it, it turns out, are completely equivalent to each other. They're in fact dual versions of one another. And each one has its advantages and disadvantages and so on. It's sort of nice that one has both ways of thinking about it, so that for any given situation, one can choose whichever route is more appropriate to that particular situation. Oops, how much more time do I have? Probably about 5 or 10 minutes, maybe. Okay, thanks. Okay, so let me sort of quickly describe, give you some flavor of what of how one understands fractionalization through either of these approaches. Let me start with this vortex theory first. So the idea, as I said, is to reformulate the original problem in terms of new variables, which one can think of as, very roughly speaking, one can think of as vortices in the many electron wave function. Right, the okay, let me also specialize to two spatial dimension. And for simplicity, let's first imagine considering a system of interacting bosons. The physics is sort of simplest in that context. Now, in two dimensions, lots of people probably know that there is some sort of duality between thinking about the interacting system in terms of the particles, the bosons, or the charge of the particles, and thinking in terms of vortices in the many boson wave function. So there's a duality between charge and vortex. In fact, there's an exact duality transformation which you can make that takes you from one description, which is in terms of the charged bosons, and another description, which is in terms of vortices in the boson wave functions. Now, in two spatial dimensions, the vortices are point-like excitation, so you can more or less think of them as particles. And so the idea is that instead of thinking about this interacting boson system in terms of the bosonic particles, you instead think in terms of the vortices, which are some weird objects in terms of the original bosons. Right? A rough way to sort of understand what one means by this is that if you think of a superfluid phase in which the bosons have condensed, then there are vortices in the system, and those vortices are finite energy gap excitations. So that's a superfluid. A superconductor, the charge has condensed, and the vortices are gapped, right? Now, if you imagine starting with the superconductor, and you imagine that because of quantum effects or whatever, that you generated lots of vortices in the system, which move all over the place, then you scramble up the face of the charge, and if the vortex motion is large enough, you basically destroy the superconductivity, and the face that you go into is an insulator. Right, so you get an insulator from the superconductor if you let the vortices proliferate and condense. Right, so this is vortices. Condensed, but a more conventional description of the insulator is in a more conventional description of insulator in terms of the particles themselves. You simply say that the charge excitation of finite gap, so the charge is gapped out. Right, so you can basically think of both these phases either in the particle language, say that the charge is condensed in the superconductor while it's gapped in the insulator. Or think of it in the vortex, in the dual vortex language, and say the vortices are gapped in the superconductor while they are condensed in the insulator. Right. There's a fundamental relation between the vorticity of the system and the value of the charge that's condensed. In particular, if the charge of the boson that you're condensing is QE, then the flux quantum of the vortex is basically HC over QE. And this, again, is something that's probably familiar to most people. Now, if you took a conventional superconductor in which you were pairing together electrons form Cooper pairs and you condense the Cooper pairs, the charge is twice that of an electron, and the fundamental vortex in such a superconductor, its strength is HC over 2E. Right? So in that sense, you manage to fractionalize, to halve the strength of the flux quantum by pairing together electrons and condensing the pair. Right? Now, given the existence of this dual way of looking at superconductors and insulators, and this statement that if you pair together the electrons form charge two objects and you condense them, you manage to halve the vorticity, one might then imagine quite reasonably that if you took an insulator, but instead of condensing ordinary vortices, you pair together the vortices and condense them, that you have the charge by this equation, right? So, exactly analogous to what you were doing in a conventional superconductor to have the vortex, but rather a dual version of it, right? And so that's the sort of basic idea of this theory of fractionalization. The first is that you can think of insulators not in the conventional sort of picture by saying that it's a system where the charged excitations are gapped, but rather in some dual language, a system in which the vortices have condensed. And the second is that so you think of the insulator as a dual superconductor for the vortices, and in this you take dual superconductor and you form dual Cooper pairs by pairing together the vortices and condensing them, and that halves the dual flux quantum, which is the physical electrical charge.
Why should you pair? If you should, then why pair and not three and not four and so on?
Okay.
Well,
that's a good question, but it's a different question from what the theory seeks to answer. Right? A line of zeros? Sorry, what do you mean by line of zeros?
Well, I will explain you later. If you have a superconductor, if you have a superconductor, and if you have one vertex state, there is a line of zeros coming out of the vortex. So you cannot encircle one electron around the vortex without crossing a line of zeros, where psi function is identical to zero.
Okay.
I can prove it to
you. Yep.
That's why I'm saying that vortex is a DCS superconductor, and in both gas, they are different.
Okay, but I mean that's sort of that may be a correct point, but it doesn't seem to be that relevant to this particular issue, right? I can show you how this. This is not the place to give you details. There is some understanding that one can get for why the vortices would pair, and it's just that when you have lots of charge motion. Suppose you had an insulator which was close to becoming a superconductor, so it had lots of charge motion, but wasn't yet superconducting, so that the charge couldn't really move orbitally large distances. Then it turns out that's something that one can see quite easily, that charge motion frustrates the motion of the single vortices. The single vortices have an extremely hard time moving once you have some amount of charge motion. And so once they are frustrated, it'd be quite difficult for such vortices to condense. But on the other hand, once you've paired up these vortices, the paired objects have not that much of a difficulty moving when you have some sort of local charge motion in the system. And so it's one might think that it's easier for them to condense than it is for the unpaired vortices. Right?
Is it comparing in an underlying electronic system or just in the purely bosonic system as well?
In an underlying electronic system. But pairing of the vortices, really.
The vortices,
yeah.
In an underlying electronic.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there is a way of looking at an electron as a vortice, and that's how J.J. Thompson...
yeah, you mentioned this before.
It's a singularity in the Maxwell speed, and emanate lines of forces emanating from that. These vortices seem to be different. Why? I would have thought that they would be the same.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Thompson's work, unfortunately, so... no, but we can talk about it later, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what he was doing, so I can't comment intelligently. Right, the... Okay. So let me just sort of briefly mention, without sort of describing in any detail, that there's a dual way of getting to this fractionalization, and that, as I said, formulates the entire problem in terms of a gauge theory. And as I said, it's a Z2 gauge theory, and that has lots of advantages. First, as I said, it's simpler to analyze than the earlier gauge theory formulations of the problem. And second, it's also quite close to the microscopics to any particular, to particular microscopic models that one may write down the context of the cuprates, for instance. And third, particularly in the context of the cuprates, it has this interesting property that it interpolates between the antiferromagnetic phase and the D-wave superconducting phase, which exists in the real superconductor. And one of the things that one can show quite reliably is that in between these two phases, you can, in principle, get a quantum phase which has this fractionalization of the electron, the interseparate spin and charge-carrying excitations. And the idea, again, as to describing confinement and deconfinement is the same as in the earlier gate theory approaches. It's just a question of whether the corresponding gate theory is in its confining or deconfining phase in that spatial dimension. Now, the advantage of the Z2 description is that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, Z2 gate theory does have a phase transition. So in fact, as some of you may know, it's dual to the global Ising model. And the global Ising model in 2 plus 1 dimensions just have a phase transition. And one of the phases is a confining phase, and the other is a deconfining phase. And by putting back the couplings to the charge and spin degrees of freedom into the gate theory, and starting from either the confining or deconfining phase, one can basically describe all sorts of conventional phase that we're used to. But in addition, we can also describe exotic phase that have fractionalized quantum numbers and so on. Anyway, so the final sort of result or summary is basically that with all this recent progress, it's now at least the theoretical question of whether or not the electron can break apart in not so special situations is, I think, firmly answered. It can indeed break apart in or understand how to describe it, and in certain cases also why it may happen. But as I said, I mean, whether or not this is useful in interpreting experiments in HTC, I mean, that one doesn't know at this stage.
Maybe let's see if there are any questions from the non-condenser.
Ill-condensed matter.
I'd like to understand whether there's anything that compels me to write C dagger is B dagger F dagger. Okay, suppose, let me phrase my question this way. Suppose I never heard of any of these modern developments and somebody gave me, say, some material that is described by, very well described by sort of elementary solid state physics.
Right.
And then I take the Hamiltonian for copper and I write C dagger, B dagger, F dagger. And presumably, as you said, if I do everything exactly, I would describe copper.
Right.
perfectly, right? But probably that's a very, very bad way of deciding to call it. So what is it that compels me in this theory to write two-dimensional?
Okay, the first thing is that we know that the conventional sort of descriptions of solid of fate, I mean, of conventional theories of solid-state physics have a hard time accounting for any of the experiments in many of these systems. And second, so given that...
Why don't I write C dagger equal to A dagger, B dagger, C dagger?
Presumably, if you could solve it exactly, you
wouldn't have to do that.
Exactly.
Right. So that's the point.
No, isn't it possible to answer some question just the way you and Matthew and others have done it, which is we know that BCS quasi particles you can write down. Yeah. And then there's this extremely natural way you guys have of showing that that's the product, basically, of your DDI phi over two kinds of wave translator. And there is an old theory, as you guys point out. Old theory that goes back to 56, whatever, 57, that has fractionalization of just the spin charge separation, just the fact you're using it. And they're telling you it's extremely natural. Or at least possible. If that operator you write down in a composite way. And
yeah.
That's an example that would make it very clear.
Let me give another example. Yeah. More or less the same thing. In a conventional BCS superconductor, the V2 gauge symmetry that we're building in there is actually spontaneously broken. It's kind of surprising, but it is.
Because of pair of
electrons. No, but one way to think about it is that the charge E spin zero excitations are condensed, and but they, in this formulation, they carry a Z2 charge, and so you're condensing something that's not Z2 neutral. And the correct description of superconductor is as a condensate, I mean, in this formulation of the charge E spin zero boson.
I mean, that was one of the real surprises that has come out, is that when you break the electron apart in this particular way, understand the conventional BCS superconductor as a condensate of charge E bosons and recover all the expected properties of a thing that we're used to thinking of as coming out of a Fermi liquid into electrons and carrying it essentially there. So this theory enables you to think about coming down into a superconductor that compiles temperatures from not a Fermi liquid, not from a quasi particle, but from a fluid of charge E bosons, and all you have to do to get superconductivity is to get that to the boson.
But in a way, isn't it sort of like, say, in the early 50s, that people would say, okay, let's take the proton field, and that's why P is QQQ, right? And as 3-4-Q, I mean, if, you know, right, it just decomposes in that way, and then we discover that it gives a natural description of strong induction. Is that the kind of the analogy that you're thinking of?
We definitely weren't motivated by strong interactions.
Well, actually, I mean, even if I want to understand a conventional BCS superconductor, I want to understand a quantum theory of both the quasi particles and the vortices. One's dealing with a theory which, in fact, has long-range statistical interactions built into it, which could be modeled very naturally in terms of this gauge theory. So it sort of emerges actually rather naturally, even inside a conventional BCS superconductor, if you start looking at both quasi particles and vortices in a quantum mechanical description, something that generally hasn't been done.
I mean, sort of a general lesson, right? You wouldn't probably argue that in a normal piece of aluminum, it's somewhat less boring than copper because it's a superconducting light, that in a normal set of aluminum, you would have to spin charge separation.
Yeah.
And I guess you would continue to argue that that's because of the coupling. Now,
No. In a normal piece of aluminium which goes superconducting, I mean, the argument would be that, at least the argument that Doug was referring to would say that you do have spin charge separation.
Below TC. You're arguing about normal state, right?
Yeah.
In a normal state, you have these interesting quasi particles. Non-electron quantum numbers, and that's the reason to worry about it, right? So what is a special condition under which it's not like aluminum where you have thermal liquid electrons, but instead these interesting particles above TC?
Well, first, I mean, this theory will not give you a serious answer to exactly when you would get this fractionalization. Rather, it would tell you that it can happen, right? And if it happens, how do you describe it? The
It gives an answer to why this will happen in aluminum.
It's the close proximity of superconductivity to a Mott insulator where there's charge E per unit cell, and when you have charge E per unit cell in the dope and you start moving around charge E objects, their motion, the motion of those charge E objects frustrates HC over 2E vortices, E versus 2E, but it doesn't frustrate the motion of HC over E vortices, so there's a natural tendency when you're doping one insulator for vortices that want to pair, and that comes out of, you know, we can see that energetically coming out of the Dedekind gauge theory. The question is, does one have enough charge fluctuations to have those vortices before one actually goes superconducting? But I think there's really sort of a natural sort of frustration between having charge E per unit cell and having HC over 2E vortices in a superconductor, which is very nearby. And that's what makes this, this sort of competition interesting.
The possibility of seeing some of these ultimate exotic phases. You might get what Yon wants if you put your aluminum yon and you made it into a very small particle. You grind up your aluminum into a bunch of very small particles, maybe 50 angstroms of size, maybe a little smaller than that. And now let those things start going down into a cold.
Why?
Because we don't have a charge capacitance. They're going to know about it, what charge you're going to know about the charge you're messing with, whether you're putting charge E or 2E or whatever on them. They're also going to go superconducting as far as the particles are, but they're not going to go phase coherent because they're going to require just some coupling to the oxide that I want around them. You're going to have this mass of objects in there that are aluminum. They have some of the superconductive properties you want. They don't have long range phase coherent, not yet. They certainly know some features about the charging these guys. I haven't thought about that system, but you're raising aluminum. And certainly aluminum, when it goes, as you say, can be looked upon as charge separate. People from others were before that treatment. You could see that way if you wanted to. Now, though, if you grind it up, make it small particles, you might be able to reach out to a phase. Isn't this sound like, is this a proposal?
No,
this is just, I'm just trying to understand the material, the talk.
No, but actually, but in some conventional low TC superconducting films, the Aaron Capitone is looking at molecular germanium in the magnetic field, so you do have vortices in there, and it's superconducting, and for strong enough fields, so you weaken the conductivity, you're getting some bizarre low temperature behavior, quasi-metallic. And that's another system where it's clear one has to be thinking about local superconductivity, vortices, by vortices, and presumably electrons and quasi-particles, because the things actually conducting in some very strange way.
A bit more formally, you talk about two different things. One of them is just splitting electron into, say, the spinon and holon, for instance, this dagger, which is a dagger times F, and another is vortices. Is it really the same thing? Or?
Yeah, they're exactly dual to one another. At least the V2 gate theory description is exactly dual to, in two dimensions, to this vortex pairing theory.
Yeah, but this splitting of this slate bosons or slate fermions, this one.
No.
Is this the same vortices, or is there two different ways to obtain some strange state?
No.
Split electron degree scale.
No. What we are doing is not slave boson or slave fermion, that kind of decomposition. It's a different formulation.
It's really different. These are two different things.
No.
What they are related.
The vortex pairing and the V2 gate theory are two different formulations of the, but are equivalent to one another.
That's
good. Right.
Thank you.